Talking with Ernst Sundel, the well-known German-Canadian Holocaust revisionist, and it's a pleasure to be here. And everyone's asking the question, what is happening in your case?
Well, let me kind of review for those who don't know me or have lost track of me.
Mm-hmm.
After all, this thing has been winding its way through the Canadian court system for over 10 years. I was targeted by Zionist groups in Canada and worldwide in the late 70s and early 80s. In the late 70s, because I had these worldwide demonstrations I organized against the Holocaust and showing of the film The Holocaust. And at one time, we had organizations going as far away as Brazil and Australia, and we demonstrated in 32 different countries. And this was a coordinated effort that basically went through my office, and naturally, the Zionists didn't like that. Then I made efforts to get access to big money, meaning Arab money, and put out an Arab language newsletter, which I sent to the whole Muslim crescent, all the way from Casablanca down to Malaysia, you know, hoping that I could get these people to help finance a worldwide information campaign, pointing out to them that it's much better for these Muslim countries to get non-Muslims to explain their particular role in history, and for us to explain to them what is happening in the Western world, that people in the West would be more likely to listen to us than to some Yasser Arafat type who needs a good shave and maybe a new suit or whatever, you know. But I got nowhere. However, the Arabs didn't support me, or the Muslims didn't support me, but the Jews got really alarmed by this around the world. And so Simon Wiesenthal wrote letters to the West German government and also to the Canadian government. I later on got into possession of these documents during my legal campaign, and he stated that Ernst Sundel is trying to lay his hands on Arab money. If he succeeds, a wave of anti-Semitism will engulf the world. And so he has to be stopped. First job was done on me in Germany by the German police, raiding over 1,500, some say 2,000 homes of my supporters there, and revealing the donor list. In other words, the German government broke the Bank Secrecy Act over there and took the donor list and book purchaser list and raided all these people's homes, which of course was a terrific blow to them, terrific blow to myself, because they thought that I had somehow handed over the list. Till we finally straightened out, I really lost about one third to one fourth of my support at that time. And in Canada, the police and the media took this signal of the raids in Germany, which was front page headline news here in Canada, that I was not really under the protection of the German government. You see, up until that point, I was treated quite fairly in Canada, frequently invited on radio and television, to schools, to civic meetings and so on, to talk about the anti-German stereotyping that is inherent in all this Holocaust material. But when the Germans signaled to the world, Ernst Sundel is basically free, you can pick on him any way that you like, then my problems here started in Canada. The Canadian government within weeks seized my mailing privileges, removed them, that I could not send any mail, receive any mail, not even my tax bills and so on. And on the 31st of May 1981, 1,500 to 2,000 Jews demonstrated outside my downtown home and office, paralyzing the traffic for some 2 hours. And that year saw my battle against or for my postal rights, because after all, I was dealing mainly by passing information through the mails into 43 countries at the time, and cutting my mail off was a devastating blow to me. Now, lucky at the time, I could still travel to the United States, and mailings were made from the United States, and we actually increased our mailing campaigns during the time when I was banned from the mail in Canada. It was inconvenient, but it didn't stop the flow of information. This so alarmed my Zionist detractors that they decided that they had to criminalize me, and had me charged in a criminal case by Sabina Citron, the lady in charge of the Holocaust Remembrance Association. And in 1983, while I was having a TV debate with her, which she lost by all accounts, at the end the announcer said, well, we'll see about this Ernst Zündel case, which will soon wind its way through the courts. I was shocked. I had never heard from the government. I hadn't heard from the police. I had to learn on a Canadian TV program where I appeared with that woman to find out that she had pressed charges against me. The government took those over very quickly. So what had been a private complaint became now the Canadian government's case. And so the province of Ontario, acting, you know, on a federal criminal complaint, prosecuted me. First, we had what in the United States would be called an impanelment of a grand jury. We don't have this system here. We have what they call a preliminary hearing, preliminary investigation. That took place in 1984 and 2 weeks. However, before that, we had near mayhem, riots, 24-hour demonstrations against my business downtown. I was to chase around the courthouse. I had to appear with bodyguards. In the end, we were 45 bodyguards because hundreds, 400 or 500 Jews flown in from all over the United States and Canada were actually there with canes and sticks. And one fellow was arrested carrying some knives which he had just purchased in a nearby store by the police. Police arrested these guys that had walking canes, pretending they had skiing accidents, which they were going to pull us out from our march into the courthouse and then hit us over the head with it and so on. There were some very tense moments. I was knocked down once, spat at usually. That's the reason why we wore helmets eventually. And I wore a bulletproof vest all the time. And eventually, when we got to the preliminary hearing state, I realized that my lady lawyer didn't do her job properly. Dr. Forison had warned me that the most difficult thing in these political court cases, revisionist court cases, was to convince your lawyer. Well, when I got to her office to discuss the fine points, I had a big portrait of Winston Churchill looking at me from behind her back, you know. So I realized that I had certainly somebody there who didn't share my viewpoint. She did a lousy job in preparing for the defense, so bad in fact that I asked the judge to ban publication of the proceedings. And you know, I had always been one to reaffirm freedom of speech and was certainly in favor of it, more media the better, because I felt we should air this publicly. Anyways, I asked for ban on publication, which completely shook not only the legal system, but also my Jewish detractors. And they misinterpreted that move by myself. They thought that I was the braggart that they had said I was, the kind of grandstanding, loudmouth nuisance that I was to them. And they interpreted my asking for a ban on publication that I was basically throwing in the towel already. That was their biggest mistake. I basically was unhappy with the defense that I was getting, or the lack of a defense I was getting. So then I cast around for a better attorney and found one in the person of Douglas Christie, who then was my defender in both Zündel cases. They wound themselves through the courts in Canada. The first trial lasted 7 weeks in 1985. Then there came various appeals, which I won in the Ontario Appeal Court, and I won in the Supreme Court. I reaffirmed the decision of the lower appeal court. I was recharged virtually while I was on the steps of the Supreme Court in Ottawa. That trial took place in 1988, 4 months in length, just about. I lost that one. I lost the appeal. Then we appeared in Ottawa on the 10th of December, 1991. And that's where the Supreme Court case basically stands now. They're reserving judgment. And usually they have about a year within which they could make a decision. Now, we were seven judges were in the Supreme Court when I appeared, not nine. One of them was a Ukrainian background judge called Sopinka, who later on went on Canadian television and spoke very firmly about freedom of speech and that these political prosecutions are dangerous. And this gives the impression that people have to have only politically correct thought, that the state dictates history. And he did a very, very good job. Almost what we heard from him was similar to what American libertarians would espouse, which is very unusual for Canada. And I interpreted that as a good sign. Many of the legal kind of pundits say, amongst them Jews, say that I should, in the end, win my case in Ottawa. I am, after having been bumped around in the Canadian system for the last 10 years, not so sure. I think I have a fairly good chance, but I'll wait till the final verdict is in. So what is waiting for me is 9 months imprisonment in Canada with a subsequent deportation from Canada, a country where I've been for 34 years.
So you spent a good part of your life fighting these battles one after the other?
Well, let me put it this way. I was in litigation in one way or another with Zionism or the professional Jews who make a living out of being Jews almost as long as Adolf Hitler was in power. And I have certainly done the work to try to clear Germany's reputation and name more than twice, almost three times as long as the National Socialist regime existed. So I have been on one heck of a long campaign, and people might have different viewpoints about myself, but one thing is for darn sure, I have stuck in there, stuck to my guns.
Well, your struggle for the last decade and a half seems to mirror a lot of what is happening in the revisionist movement worldwide.
Well, I think that with all modesty, I can claim a certain responsibility for the rapid spread of revisionism. Because once I realized the truths that were found by people like Dr. Forison, by Paul Razzini, by Dr. Butts in England, I realized that it was no good to keep it in the what we call ivory tower establishment, just make it a kind of intellectual exercise, or keep it in the intellectual playpen of a bunch of university professors or academics. I am a man of action and street action. I am a populist. I believe that the people ought to be informed, and that an informed public makes usually fairly sound decisions. And the public makes only poor decisions if they don't get proper information. It's a matter of garbage in, garbage out. And so I thought in the old American way, let the people know the truth and the republic shall be safe. So I went on a conscious effort to organize or to orchestrate a worldwide intellectual movement in revisionism. Where there were before individuals working alone in their lofts or their offices, after Ernst Zündel, I can claim that for myself, I kind of plugged them in and connected them with one another, and the information exchange became much more rapid and more on an organized basis. Documents were exchanged rapidly, electronically, overnight through fax machines and so on. In other words, I brought business acumen, since I was a businessman. I brought dynamism because I was a young fellow. At the time, I had lots of women vigor, you know. I brought this to the movement, and I brought a certain amount of peasant common sense to this, you know. And I wanted these fantastic truths to be simplified that everybody could understand them. And so I went on this big splurge of writing to radio stations and TV stations, and appeared annually in roughly 140, 150 radio talk shows in the United States, in Canada, and Australia. And we calculated, every time I would ask the station when they called me, what's your potential leadership, listenership, they said, when I totaled everything up, there would certainly be amount of overlapping, that my voice would be heard in each year by about 300 million people.
Hmm. Well, you seem to be in touch with every important revisionist activist.
I've made a point, whenever and wherever I could travel, and I say that advisedly because I'm banned from the United States since 1987. I've been banned from Austria since 1988. I was barred from Germany because they didn't give me a passport for over 6 years. And so I was stuck here in the Canadian Gulag. And maybe that the reason was for these bans was that I was basically a fellow that would travel to see the men that I was corresponding with, because I always found it a very good idea to sit across from somebody and to kind of size a person up. And this is where we got much better cooperation out of it, you know. So, yes, I am in touch with virtually all well-known revisionists, from Dr. Forison, whom I consider the world's pope of revisionism. He is, in without any doubt, the greatest revisionist scholar alive today. And Dr. Butts, the American Arthur Butts, is, in my opinion, a close second, but he doesn't engage himself in as passionately as Dr. Forison. David Irving is maybe the best known revisionist, but as Dr. Forison correctly calls him, he is the man of the 11th hour. In other words, Dr. Forison doesn't forgive him that he took so long before he came off the fence and adopted what we now call new history.
Mm-hmm. What have you heard from David Irving in the recent past?
I met David Irving the summer of 92 in Munich, where he had just returned from Moscow, and where he shared with me the first few pages of the Goebbels diaries, which he had found there, kind of gathering dust in the archives, the special archives apparently of the KGB or some Soviet archives, which had not even a nameplate on the door, some secret, hitherto secret archive. And what came out of there was really something, and the media, of course, has had a field day. The Daily Mail had 20 pages on in one issue, and the Times is serializing the Goebbels diaries. And so people keep saying, well, what's Irving's purpose and so on? Number one, Irving is a historian. He earns his livelihood by printing, by being in the news. That obviously helps book sales for him. Also, undoubtedly, the Times of London paid him handsomely for his translating services. He is not allowed to comment the diaries, and I'm just as happy about that for the time being, because the more raw history that we can get translated directly out of the pen of Goebbels, the closer we are to the truth, as this man saw it, being one of the leaders of the Third Reich. But Irving also is traveling widely. He had a very successful lecture tour in Australia, a very immensely successful 11-city tour in South Africa, from which he apparently now thinks that he is banned. He's not quite sure. And he had a 13-city speaking tour in Canada. He was in Argentina, where he found the diaries or the notes typed anyhow by Adolf Eichmann, was given that by some man in Argentina. So this man keeps ahead of the pack, and there is no doubt in my mind that although he might not be the foremost revisionist scholar in understanding and detail knowledge, he is a great popularizer. And because he is multilingual, speaks fluent Spanish, beautiful German, speaks French passably enough that he appeared on French television talking about the Goebbels diaries, and in French. You see, that's the beauty. Doesn't need to be interpreted. And so the sound bites come directly out of his own mouth, his own brain, therefore, you know. If he didn't exist, we'd have to pay millions to invent David Irving. He has become the locomotive of revisionism. And we don't want to forget the American effort from the Institute for Historical Review. Certainly, they have been a stalwart, a kind of almost like a beacon of light, a lighthouse for the revisionist movement. They have spun off many, many worthwhile projects. Bradley Smith's project, Committee for an Open Debate on the Holocaust, you know, your own material on your remarks. And there is Bradley Smith, I mentioned, because Bradley is actually independent of the IHR, you know, and he had the radio project, which was really a worthwhile project, getting onto all kinds of talk shows. He's been on all kinds of television shows. The IHR effort has spawned this fellow Cole, a Jewish revisionist. I've just been contacted by two more Jewish revisionists, one calling himself a doctor, so he's obviously an academic with some kind of a degree. So it could possibly be that on the one hand, with the revelations coming out of the archives in the Soviet Union, Goebbels' diaries, death books of Auschwitz being released by Gorbachev, Gorbachev admitting to the Poles that the Soviets were responsible for Katyn, all this revision of history, that's really basically what it is, we have entered the mainstream. We were the pioneers. We still are in the forefront of it. But what was spawned in 1979 at the Institute for Historical Review, Los Angeles, California, has borne fruit beyond my wildest imagination. I never thought that we would become that popularly known, that the New York Times would say one has to deal with those revisionist historians, you know? You can't just ignore them. And we are a grassroots movement, which is unusual, you know? History usually was dealt with by academics, but we have made it into a grassroots movement with organized campaigns of information, pamphleteering, postering, handbills handed out in all kinds of cities around the world. We have a monthly combined output of information, minimum 500,000 circulation. So we are a media force. And because of the dedication of our followers, the idealism, the sacrifices made by people like yourself, myself, others, we get more than maximum bang for the buck.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps so, it's a sign of our success that all these laws are being passed in Austria and France and elsewhere that outright ban revisionism.
In a perverse way, you're right. You know, this is what is exactly it. The authorities behind which is this powerful Zionist lobby, Israel lobby, are trying to broom back the tide of history. But as Doug Christie said when I was convicted the last time, prisons make very leaky containers for ideas. And they can imprison the messenger, but they cannot kill the message. You know, the governments of the world, the Western world, are showing their moral bankruptcy by trying to stave off the inevitable. And instead of admitting that war is a terrible thing for all concerned, and that lies are being told routinely in wartime by most governments, and that there are some people who profited beyond the war from this thing, they have chosen the route to stifle freedom of speech, to break their own laws, their own human rights codes, and so on. And in the end, I think that what we're going to see is a toppling of these governments from below. In other words, there is an East German future, maybe in West Germany, and there is certainly going to be a Soviet Union-like upheaval in store, I believe, for countries like Canada and the United States. You see, we are not just dried, cut and dried academic phrase dissectors and weighing this semicolon against that exclamation mark and so on. History is a very powerful thing. And if a people has been betrayed or misused or abused and has been bamboozled, especially like the long-suffering American people by their politician, I think they're going to vent their wrath. And you can see in the election campaigns that are going on, there is an attempt at replacing the old oligarchy. And although it's not really well articulated yet, we will have a role in articulating it. And if it's not in this round of elections, before this decade is out, the world will look so very differently. And believe me, there can be only one winner in this, and that will be us.
Yes. There's a robust trust of governments.
Everywhere. Yeah. Yes. I just returned from Europe again. I've gone to Europe virtually every 6-7 weeks since I was able to travel, and the judges released me from this travel restriction, and I got my passport back from the German government. I won it back in litigation over a period of 6 years, went to the highest level of courts in West Germany before I got it back. But nevertheless, since I can travel again, I can assure you that there is what we call in German Staatsverdrossenheit, which is a fatigue the German people have with the state. And that manifests itself that they don't come to the defense if a policeman is beaten, you know, that they don't pay their taxes the way they used to, that everybody is trying to chisel with taxes, that what is unheard of in Germany, people are being blown up, shot. I mean, we used to look at this as a typical American way, you know, for in Germany, for somebody, well, in 70, 80 years, no German statesman was assassinated inside Germany since Walter Rathenau, you know. It should be borne in mind that Adolf Hitler, if he was so hated as the Allies claim, or his government, had to be removed by a world war, and that the leaders had to be dragged through Allied kangaroo courts on drummed up charges with a rigged court case and be executed, not by the German people. The German people never laid hands on their leaders. The Allies did the murdering.
Mm-hmm.
Once they were the victors. So this is we should bear this in mind. And I think when we're looking around the world, revisionism is showing geopolitical victories. Who would have thought that we who delve in books could revise the borders of the Soviet Union?
Mm-hmm. Well, even though there's a law in Austria, for instance, that you can't deny the story of World War II, the juries are apparently very reluctant to prosecute under that.
That's
so they've changed it so it's a very variable sentence from 1 year to life.
Yeah. But you see, this also will wear thin because people will find a way of replacing the legislators who corrupted the laws to the point where the law became a prostitute, where the judicial system became a prostitute for the ruling oligarchy. This is usually the beginning of the end. You know, this is like a Noriega-like system that they adopted in Austria, and they did the same in France against Jean-Marie Le Pen and Cardinal Lefebvre. You know, in order to criminalize their political opposition, they stooped to redistricting, to forbidding this, and you can't say that. And in the end, in the history, the strength of ideas will topple most man-made rules and regulations. It's like the speed limit in the United States. Most of the truckers cruise along at 70, 80 miles an hour, ignoring the 55-mile speed limit. Why? Because they have got CB radios and they have a network amongst themselves, because a 55-mile speed limit for these truckers deprives them of their livelihood. And so they're having those stupid laws. I mean, in America you drive 55 miles an hour, in Germany you drive an unlimited speed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not very many more accidents in Germany, statistically, than there are in the United States, I can guarantee you. So, I mean, laws, as Lenin said, laws are made like pie crusts, they're made to be broken. If law doesn't correspond to the sentiment of the people, you will have what the Americans did with their American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Turn the bastards out.
Well, what about this fellow in Sweden, Ahmed Rami?
Ahmed Rami, the Moroccan, is an interesting fellow. He's short in stature. He was a former officer of the Moroccan military. And I don't know if you knew this, but he had to flee Morocco because he tried to overturn the rule of the king, King Hassan, in a military putsch together with other junior officers. And they all look like Americans, dressed in American-style uniforms, riding on patent tanks, It's basically, it was almost like an American Banana Republic-type revolution against this Algerian government. It failed, and so he fled to Sweden. They gave him political asylum, and there he became a Holocaust revisionist. And he has got this little Muslim radio station, and he certainly is making big waves. He has already gone to prison once for not being more deferent, showing more deference to the Jews in Sweden. It doesn't seem to deter him. Now, the interesting thing is that he could also get no money from any Arab source, and he is basically living off handouts in a job which he has just lost recently. So the persecution and the reaction to revisionism seems to be the same worldwide, which leads me to think, if it looks like a duck and squawks like a duck, prefers water like a duck, most likely what we're dealing with is a duck. And that since the reaction and the repression and the brutality visited upon revisionists around the world, from the beating of Dr. Faurisson to the beating of David Irving, to the beating of Ernst Zündel, from the bombing of my house to the bombing of my store, the attempted bombing of my store and a German right-wing newspaper in Munich, is the same pattern. We are dealing with an organized, orchestrated, worldwide counteroffensive against revisionists. And there is only one quarter and one source where this comes from, and the IHR recently sent me a fax, urgent fax, distributed around the world, that they have information that there is a new Mossad link to a group called Tagar, which would be similar to the early 70s Jewish Defense League arm called the Chaya, or some Chayas, some Hebrew name meaning force. And it basically means animal squad. And these, in the 70s, we were tangling and had the beatings and the fisticuffs with the Jewish Defense League militant offspring, this what they call the animal squad. And the Jewish Defense League has faded into the memory hole since the execution or assassination, I'm not quite sure by whom, of Rabbi Kahane. And now they have obviously spawned a new group of terrorists. So every revisionist ought to be conscious of this and be careful.
So your store was?
Well, they placed two powerful bombs around my store, one in the front shop window and one in the side entrance. And luckily, one employee found it in Munich and called the police, and it was dismantled before it could explode. And at the same time, the same morning, in the same city, the Münchener Anzeiger, a mass circulation newspaper like you have in the United States now, where it lives off advertising and has no sales price, 480,000 circulation, that have covered repeatedly large articles on revisionism, they also became the target of a bomb.
So they were targeted for their coverage?
There was what we call in German ein Bekennerschreiben, meaning somebody took credit for it, just like they took credit in the bombing here Here it was a Jewish group, and they called the television station. They said, yeah, we are a kind of a militant Jewish organization, and we're going to make sure that Zündel is silenced. And the telephone terror that has been going on against me for years now, they're openly admitting that they are Jewish. They're calling from Israel day and night, long distance, collect, and from other countries. We're dealing with an organized campaign, well financed by these Zionist interests that want to prevent the truth from coming out.
There's also that young fellow in the Chicago area, Ed Mueller, who was wearing an Ernst Zündel t-shirt and then was attacked by two men.
I heard about that. And in East Germany, one young fellow, 18 years old, father of a child, married, was just stabbed to death in some dispute. And then there was, of course, the shooting of this fellow Sonntag in Dresden by two pimps from the Frankfurt kind of prostitution thing. They were cleared, by the way. They were arrested in Bangkok, where they had fled to, and then they were cleared in the German court case, obviously by intimidated judges in East Germany. Oh, yeah, so this Dr. Faurisson's assailants, which nearly killed him, he has already had 8 assaults against him, physical assaults. Not once did anybody catch anybody in France. On the 20th of April last year, some French cultural group had a kind of a celebration planned because they could only get the hall that night. Happens to be Hitler's birthday. The local Jews in France figured that they were celebrating out of Hitler's birthday, and some 20 people attacked these elderly folks, killed one apparently, and split the head open of another person that was in a coma for a long time. These are these type of people.
Well, at least Ed Mueller was okay. He only got a broken jaw, which is still 6 weeks worth of suffering.
Yeah, I can only advise everybody not to be paranoid, but it's not something shameful to defend your skin and your life in a very spirited way. In Canada, unfortunately, the state disarms its citizens totally. You know, we have no right to keep and bear arms. Now they've just outlawed in Canada the phaser, the stun gun, as you call it, you know, these little electric charge. Oh, yeah. And you can't use tear gas in Canada. You can't use these little mace spray cans in Canada. And we have one old man who was jailed for a year because he used one of those spring-loaded things that you have, like a club, little thing in the United States. So Canada is disarming its citizens and leaving them to the mercy of these goons.
Well, the goons are always cowards. They always attack in far larger numbers than their opponents.
And then, of course, we have this constant canceling of halls, venues where people want to speak, and the kind of canceling of radio appearances. So the repression is real, and it is orchestrated, and it is alive and well in Canada. But that doesn't discourage us from carrying on within the framework of the legal breathing space that we have, and you living in the United States and reaching many people in the United States with your excellent publication remarks, and now with videotapes and with audio tapes, I can only say the United States is the bastion of free speech in the Western world. Believe me.
Yes.
And I was delighted to hear that the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the right for people to display the swastika, for instance, and for Klansmen to burn crosses. Even though I'm not a Klansman, and I certainly wouldn't go to some black person's house and plant a cross there just to aggravate them. I think that is nothing political, that's just pranks and stupid, you know. But I was impressed by in which spirit the American Supreme Court defended freedom of speech. There is not another country, not in Switzerland, certainly not in my experience in Germany, and no longer in England, and absolutely not in Canada. There's not a country where freedom of speech is as highly valued by thinkers as it is in the United States. And that augurs well for us. And I'm glad to hear it. We've got a breathing space. You know that we were under attack with these hate laws and so on. And I think that put the brakes on the Jewish lobby down there. So I congratulate you, Americans. Hang in there, you know.
We Americans have a perverse individualistic streak, and I think all these reports of opposition around the world just make us more determined. And
I think that's a good idea. And I have my bones to pick with the older generation of Americans that allowed these two world wars with their acquiescence. Not if it wasn't with their active help, and mostly active help, it was certainly with the acquiescence of the vast majority of the American people that Roosevelt and Wilson got involved in those two world wars.
Yes.
Now, I don't care what the opinion poll said 2 weeks before the war broke out. I only take notice of the fact that the Germans were bombed and beaten to smithereens, and even after the war had their men killed by a policy of starvation.
Yes.
So, you know, you can't blame all that on the Jews. You
no.
have to blame some stupid goyim who
yes.
would do this, you know? Mindless people who blame the Germans at every moment, you know, for not speaking up and not standing on their hind legs and all that. And when they were called to make a resistance move to their democratically allegedly elected governments, they caved in just like everybody
yes.
else.
Yeah, two generations of Americans let themselves be bamboozled and propagandized into going across the ocean to solve the world's problems, but only made it worse.
Yeah, and to me, you see, speaking as a German, now, this is very subjective, I understand this and I know it, but Americans have been loud and frequent in condemning all things German in the last 80 years, you know, so allow me to condemn certain things American, you know. And I can only say to friend and foe, there is such a thing as collective guilt. You have inflicted it on the German people since 1918. We were all to sign, my grandfather's generation, that we were guilty for starting the First World War. That was an American idea, you know, with the Treaty of Versailles that was foisted mm-hmm. upon us once we were laying down our arms following Wilson's 14-point promise, you know?
Yes.
So twice we hear this moralizing coming from across the ocean. And we say to you, there is a moral responsibility that America at large, be they Jewish, German American, Irish American, Hispanic American, Black American, all Americans have taken upon themselves this load. They are collectively responsible, not only for what was done to the Germans during the war or in defeat after the war for such obscenities like the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, but Americans are collectively guilty what happened to the world since. Because they
yes.
survived, they made sure that Marxism survived. So every single living American that was alive then and has since come on stream, so to speak, is responsible through its wheat shipments and all the rest of this stuff to have kept the evil empire
yes.
alive, because it was an evil empire when it was conceived and it was known by many American thinkers and it was broadcast widely. Father Coughlin used to have 31 million listeners to his radio stations, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The American people cannot claim ignorance of these facts, and the facts were available to them. So they are certainly, if not guilty of the sin of commission, they are guilty with the sin of omission, you know?
Well, to play the devil's advocate just a little bit, the communist government of the Soviet Union could get wheat at a cheaper rate of interest, and the farmers who were growing it
sure.
could get a loan for their equipment. And you know,
have the same
some farmers have fought that, you know, some people have been
sure.
aware of it.
Oh, understand
this,
you know, and I'm saying I know, and I count amongst my friends, many fantastic Americans. If anybody loves what America could have been, it's Ernest Jindal, and I've said that far and wide on every
mm-hmm.
radio broadcast, that there are two, even though right-wingers in quote or revisionists might criticize the Bill of Rights and the American Constitution, I say to you that from what I have seen and from the systems that I have lived under, been tried under, and jailed under, and be arrested by, the American system is by far the most superior, and these two documents are the most enlightened documents
mm-hmm.
that I know that exist on the planet today. And if we can create or recreate American men of character and women, then these documents are just fine. You don't need to
yeah.
monkey around with them. The problem is that they have perverted the essence of them by the application of allowing such things as hate laws even
yes.
to be passed through legislatures and so on.
There's
so
also been a terrible collapse of leadership in America, that people that should be standing up for moral freedoms and
yeah.
are beginning to knuckle under to ADL hate laws that are being written
sure.
by teams of lawyers.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the golden handcuffs. The current ruling oligarchy has understood to envelop everybody in these golden handcuffs where you have mortgages to pay, and where you become what Adolf Hitler called an interest slave, you know, where in order to pay the mortgage interest rates, you keep your mouth shut in order that you keep your job, in order that you can keep the mortgage paid. And the prime, in the prime of your life, is also when the greatest amount of debt has been piled on you, you know. And so this is the mechanism frequently by which they control dynamic people who would otherwise strike a blow for freedom. I understand all this, but you know, it's a it doesn't give somebody a total out for not speaking up for the for his generation on and for his children's generation, because after all, every parent, every father, every mother leaves this new crop of Americans behind in America, and they ought to make sure that they live in an America like it was bequeathed to the father's generation.
Well, especially American academics have betrayed truth and history. They're more interested in their tenure and their salaries and their summer vacations than they are in really researching the truth. So it takes...
That's why I say to you that we have to popularize this struggle even more. And I'm delighted to hear when people like yourself, you have parties and people then go out and they sticker or they handbill, leaflet, anything. Right. This is to me what is needed. Our enemies are totally unnerved by this kind of street action, because never before has an intellectual idea, an academic exercise delving into history, been taken to the masses via the streets. You know, we have had ideological revolutions and we have Marxists on the barricades and all this, but we'd never had a viewpoint of history being taken to the streets the way we revisionists have taken to the streets. It's I think it's we are a credit to our race and to our ancestors the way we have been going about this, you know, that we have taken the vilification from the main media, from our friends, sometimes even from our spouses, wives, mothers, even our children look at us askance, you know, and yet many of us have stood the test of time and stood like rocks in with the surf coming in, you know. This this is not a generation of cowards only. We also have a generation of heroes next to the many millions who have buckled under. So it's almost, you could say, like a mirror image. There was extreme cowardice and irresponsibility on one side, and on the other side rose an übermensch, a form of übermensch, you know, a man that, like Irving and Forreston, that would stand up and say, up until here and no further.
Yes. You know? So. Well, there's a potential for a renaissance of thought, I think, everywhere, including America. Although I think Americans are maybe more brain dead than Europeans are.
No, I don't believe that at all. No, I really don't. It's unfair to say that about Americans, because, believe me, I've toured Europe from the north to the south, from the east to the west, in the last few years, and I gave lots of speeches, had lots of question and answer periods, met with lots of individual thinkers and so on. Americans are a good natural selection of most of the Aryan tribes of Europe. And I see that America actually plays a kind of a seminal role, you know, because you have more freedom. Many of the truths that Europeans are exploiting have come from the United States. So that little stalwart bunch of Americans, who freedom fighters, intellectual minutemen, if you wish, you know, the Paul Revere's of the revisionist movement, you know, they have played a major role, certainly in helping to enlighten myself, and the seminal role of the IHR should not be underestimated. Whatever one might think of its component parts or different moves that they have made, like paying off Mermelstein or anything like this, the sum total of it is that they have done a very useful role, not only for the United States, but worldwide. Now, we were touching upon, is there a chance for redemption of America? Yes, certainly. And we, not only for America, the whole Western world is virtually gleichgeschaltet intellectually, is this annexation, you know, the mental annexation. Hitler made a political annexation of Austria, apparently. Well, a mental annexation has taken place of most of the civilized countries. We have so many American films that are being shown to us. The fashion is America. America is basically still the dominant trendsetter, you see? And I think, therefore, America's role is not over yet, and I think it's going to be enhanced, because we have seen the race riots in Los Angeles and in these other places. These were, you could say, stupidly destructive moves by blacks against, in many cases, Koreans or Chinese or non-whites. But I think it's also, there is like a chance for renewal in here. I was stunned by how freely the liberals on the television networks suddenly realized that integration, forced integration, had not worked, and how freely the blacks were discussing the failure of integration. So I think we are seeing the beginning of the end of this social experiment without equal in the history of the modern world, and that Americans, both black and white and Korean and Jewish, are going to be rethinking whether this really is the formula that we thought it was. And there are many, many voices of many well-known people that during the Los Angeles race riots and the aftermath clearly stated that integration had failed America.
Yes.
So, having said that, what is there to be discussed? Communism is dead. It has failed as an alternative, unless some Red Bonaparte is going to go and install himself in Russia proper and recreate another Ivan the Terrible kind of regiment in the Soviet, in the former Soviet Union, in today's Imperial Russia, whatever you want to call it, whatever this geopolitical mass of states he might dominate. If that doesn't happen, and I see nothing like that on the horizon, I only see more dissolution in the East. I see more inter-ethnic rivalries. I see expulsions of Volga Germans, for instance, that were sent to Kazakhstan from there. The Kazakhs want to be amongst Kazakhs. They don't want to have Germans amongst them. The Germans don't want to live at the rear end of the world in Mongolia. They want to be back with Germans, you know. And so I think we're going to see in the next 10 years a rearranging of the ethnic maps or the ethnic patterns there. It's apparent everywhere. The Slovaks separating from the Czechs. All these artificially created, sometimes Freemasonic inspired artificial combinations of states or ethnic groups that, you know, you could not contain except by bribes and terror and so on. All this is going to sort itself out. We're going to have, I think, decentralization in the world, and with decentralization will come an increase in personal responsibility, personal self-government. I think that's a very healthy way in the right direction. I think the role of these magnificent, uniform, unitary states like Charles de Gaulle's France or Adolf Hitler's Germany, I think we're going to see less of that, which brings us to Europe.
Right.
You know, what is the future holding in Europe? I think we're going to see an Europa Ethnica, as they would say in Latin, you know, a Europe where administrative borders will be drawn largely corresponding to linguistic or tribal borders. We're going to see possibly in another 10 years blood grouping, where people will find out by blood tests predominantly to what tribe they belong, because they have done tremendous breakthroughs through DNA and so on in that. And just as an aside, we know, for instance, that there's a lot of Celts living in the area of Cherbourg that have the same blood group as they have in Wales, you know, considerable distance away. And so we might find, we might be very surprised, the kind of interesting patterns that we're going to see. I think we're going to see a more inward turning of European people. In other words, the Welsh will be wanting to stay with the Welsh and will be marrying Welsh. The Welsh language will get a flowering. The Bavarians and all these kind of, not tribal, but kind of dialects will play a big role under a larger umbrella, you know, of a kind of a united Europe. Not the Freemasonic artificial creation that they have concocted at this moment, to which even little Denmark said no in a plebiscite. I think there will be other countries in Europe that will say no. England might just be one of them. It will not mean the end of a coming together of Europe. I hope not, because I am a European, you know. And this internecine warfare that we had with French killing Englishmen, Germans, and vice versa, it must stop. I'm delighted, even if it costs billions, you know. I'm much more in favor of the current process of finding a modus operandi where we Europeans can find together, as long as we guard against the influx of people that are of non-European background. The biggest fear in the next 10 years is basically to keep these people at the borders of Europe, contained inside Europe, so that we can sort out what we want to do with Europe.
Well, don't you have to have nationalistic, at least regional governments, which will keep the these diverse elements from all over the world coming in, just on the basis of that they're refugees and they're not related and they're just coming for better jobs and
thinking in the mold of normal statecraft, you're absolutely correct, and regional governments can deal actually very effectively with bottling up these intruders, because they're ethnically and culturally and linguistically don't belong in there. Usually it is the nation, that the nation state, that hasn't the political will to reject these people. For instance, I was told that in American context, the federal army, the armed forces of the United States, are the greatest and most brutal agency for racial integration. See, I bet you that this is correct. When you look at the American armed forces and the not only racial integration but also sexual integration, the same bathrooms for men and women and all this kind of stuff. So this interim period, we might see local reactions, for instance, like we saw in Hoyerswerda in East Germany, where young skinheads, hardly any of them older than 20 years old, created such a stink on the street and a ruckus against these people that they shipped them out, that the state actually shipped them out, you see? So there is popular will, is listened to. Mm-hmm. Popular will just has not been galvanized and organized and is not being articulated properly yet.
There's not much time. Great Britain was flooded in maybe 15, 20 years, and now there's a very serious racial problem.
See, it's interesting what you're raising there. You're thinking really like a man from the outside in, a cool intellectual analyzing the situation. Look at it this way. The Europeans, in their arrogant ignorance, used to blame the United States, like Canadians used to blame the United States, for mishandling the racial problem, and their racial policies. Until such time that in England they had the Brixton riots. Since Europeans have been confronted by what America has been confronted for over 200 years, they have been eating far more humble pie, because they too haven't done a good job, have failed actually with the race problem, because there is really no solution outside of separation. Africans don't belong in Europe, and Europeans don't belong into Africa unless Africa has died of AIDS, and we're going to repopulate an entire continent. So, brings us to AIDS.
Yes.
I believe that AIDS is the one component that we who think ideologically or politically or geopolitically or in historical terms, which you only can by looking backwards, we had not encountered this disease called AIDS. And AIDS is the wild card in all our thoughts. You see, I've collected more material on AIDS than I have by now on the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I find the Holocaust an academic exercise, and I'm no longer interested in it because, to my satisfaction, intellectually speaking, I have solved this question. Mm-hmm. The rest are little niggling details that others can iron out. As far as I'm concerned, the Leuchter Report and the death books from Auschwitz by Gorbachev, which he turned over, forensic studies made on the ground in various gas chambers, alleged gas chambers and so on, have answered this question. Now to me, we have to look for the future. I will, Ernst Zündel at least, will look for the future, and to me, AIDS is one of the issues that we have to keep a close eye on, because with AIDS will come terrible disease, terrible hardships, tremendously high hardships, many, many, many high costs, sometimes near bankrupt costs for our health services, which means our own people will be in great jeopardy. And so we ought to, out of a sense of personal responsibility for our children, ourselves, our own marriage partners and so on, address ourselves to this issue and take steps now, if it's not already too late, but take steps now to isolate ourselves from the potential disease-carrying areas, We can do it by physical separation, we can do it by putting distance between us and the potential source of the trouble. We can do it by keeping our bodies healthy and not having to go to hospitals.
Yes.
Being reckless, not being reckless in driving, that we don't have accidents, you know, by not going to eat in restaurants where we know a certain clientele either cooks or serves or washes the dishes, and by practicing a healthy, natural lifestyle, no perversions, not taking dope, which of course most sensible people shouldn't do anyways, by keeping the immune system in your body up, by not smoking or boozing unduly, you know. I'm beginning to sound like I'm some kind of a Christian revivalist,
a Puritan.
A Puritan. No, but I'm saying, as long as we remain true to the values of our ancestors,
yes.
you know, everything will be okay. This world is nothing to be frightened of. And when I look, I was in East Germany just recently, gave a couple of speeches there, at the young people that are coming on stream, I like to call it, the 13 to 19, 20 years old. And I see them in Canada and also in the United States. We have quite a good quality youth. And those that have the intelligence or open their minds to truth that is put before them, the worthwhile ones, they are no worse than we were, believe me, in many ways. I've got two sons, and when I watch their friends and what they discuss amongst one another and how they behave towards one another, I am really encouraged. You know, my children's friends are decent kids. They don't go around not working an 8-hour day. In other words, they're not lazy. They're not going to want a free ride and all this kind of stuff. Not our children. There might be others in our midst who are parasites, but I have seen lots and lots of white or Aryan children that are as good as we were, if not better, that are as sharp as we were, if not smarter. And I think the future, if we engage all ourselves, you know, with all our interests and body and soul, we can get through this next 10-year crisis, and boy, there's a bright future ahead for all of us.
So you sound very optimistic.
I certainly do.
A future of revisionism and...
Revisionism will pass then into history. We will become the writers of history, as it should be, because history is a living process, will constantly be devised, hopefully. We should never allow intellectuals to practice the quiet of the graveyard, you know. The Aryan race is an interesting group of people. Always have been, always will be, if we watch out for our health, and we will not succumb. This is not yet the decline of the West, as Oswald Spengler talked about. This is just a little dip in the chart, you know, of our race, and I see that we will catch our stride and we'll go on to new heights, and we will leave the planet and conquer the universe. I see, if we heed common sense, I see nothing but a glorious future for us.
As long as we keep on creating a new group of leaders coming up, you know, new people who know the score.
We do that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.